you know, we're the ones that keep it wicked. Rock and roll, all good, mix it up, that's my ticket. Cruising in my Cadillac Escalade.
Good morning and welcome to episode 44 of the Deck Tees podcast, brought to you by LegitMTG.com. My name is Erin Campbell. With me today, I have a very special someone who's going to talk about some of the rules changes that we have to look forward to starting in July, I believe. Level 3 judge and meme superstar, Kim Warren. Hello.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. So what's it like being a meme?
It was kind of an accident.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I was doing in that photo, but it took off quite a bit for about a week.
That was actually the first taste that I'd really had of you. Like, I had heard of your name. I knew that you were a very respected judge. Even when I first started the Deck Tees and I was looking for potential guests, your name had sort of come up as, you should have Kim Warren on your show. And I didn't know much about you. And then I belonged to several Facebook groups where, you know, lady MTG players get together. And somebody had posted the meme. And I was like, she looks cool. Like, I don't know much about her, but I would hang out with her. And then I started following you on Twitter. And we've talked a little bit. And you certainly haven't let me down. You're definitely very intelligent and you seem good at what you do, and you also seem fun. Like I said, I would totally hang out with you if you were at an event.
That's always a bonus point. I tend to like trying to be the kind of person that people want to talk to at events, because it's much more interesting that way than sort of hanging out in my own corner and telling people to get out.
Right. I think that's one thing I like about the judges, is at least the ones that I've seen, you guys don't try hard to be intimidating looking. I know judges already have sort of a weird stigma about them where people feel like you're always out to get them and, you know, things like that. And the ones that I run into try really hard to, you know, sit down and watch a game and banter with you a little bit. And they seem to know when to lose that face and be one of the players. And I really appreciate that.
I think most of us would struggle to look intimidating if we tried. We're not the most physically imposing bunch, but...
I think you could pull it off. Like, I mean, that meme alone made me a little scared of you. I was like, she'll cut you. Like, just...
there was nearly a second attempt. Someone posed a second attempt, not knowing of the previous meme. I just did a short interview at the last PTQ about some rules things that some guys were making a video from the last PTQ. And... at some point, I have a not sure of serious face on that he proposed turning into a meme until someone linked to the previous one.
They were like, you're too late. It's been done before.
Yeah, pretty much. Apparently, that's a common facial expression.
Yeah. I wonder if you can maybe like copyright that or trademark. Like, I'm giving you the Kim Warren right now. Like, you know, I would give
you the Kim Warren. What the hell are you doing?
Next thing you know, you'll be like a Wikipedia entry or an Urban Dictionary entry. The Kim Warren, the look of death someone gives you when they're not happy with you.
I maintain a sense of fear about ever looking up someone's name on Urban Dictionary. I'm pretty sure there's nothing you want to find in that.
That's very true. It's very true. So now you are coming to me from France, is that right?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, but you're English.
I'm dating another level 3 judge and have been for 2 years. So last August, I finally moved out to France to study a master's here. Mm-hmm. And live with him.
Now, interesting. You're dating another judge. Now, what's that like?
It's actually really convenient. It was especially when I was living in the UK and he was living in France, mm-hmm. because it basically meant that we both went to all the GPs in Europe and got to hang out at those.
Interesting.
So that was the start of our relationship, was basically just meeting up in the evenings of GPs. And, you know, eventually we started traveling separately to events as well.
Interesting. Now, have you guys always been at the same level? Because you had mentioned that you're both level 3s. So did you start off as level 1s and you got to know each other as you leveled up? Or was one of you higher level than the other?
No, at the point we met the first time, which was probably the massive event in Paris when they did a GP and a Pro Tour at the same time. So it barely counts. You met every judge in the world there, but you never remembered any of them because the staff was like 70 or something. Mm. I was level 1 and he was probably level 3 already. When we actually got to know each other, I was level 2 and he was level 3.
Mm-hmm. Did he help you in that process of getting higher level?
He did help me, yeah. Actually, the first time that I ever team led on a GP, when you're a level 2 and you team lead on a day 2 of a GP, you have a level 3 on your team who shadows you. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the level 3 on my team at my first team lead before we started dating.
Interesting. It's very cool. Yeah, I know I've had this conversation with people before on my show. It definitely, I feel like magic is one of those hobbies where it really helps if who you're dating is into it as well. And I think Roberto Gonzalez, he'd even use the phrase, once your brain is soaked in mana, it's very hard to get rid of that, because you do, magic does become so much of your vernacular. And if you're dating somebody who doesn't understand, you kind of lose them a little bit. And I feel, especially if you're a judge, you know, it helps as someone who can relate to what you're going through.
Yeah. I mean, we're both very highly involved in the judge program, so it's especially true. I think in the last 2 years, there's been one GP in Europe that I missed that he was at, and I think there may have been one that he missed as well. Mm-hmm. We've also both been to America and done some GPs over there. We went to Kuala Lumpur last year as well for one. So being able to do all of that traveling together rather than those weekends, meaning that we don't see each other, is a massive bonus. And also, it's things like I'm a regional coordinator, so I help look after and keep an eye on all the judges in the UK, which is quite time consuming. He's actually the net rep for the judge rules questions and things. So he has to answer a lot of judges' questions. And so from his side, that's time consuming. Mm-hmm. But we can talk to each other and interact with each other on that because of both being judges.
Right. Now, I have to ask, I know the judges they work very hard at being professional and in keeping a very professional face about them. Was there any friction that you guys received for cohabitating as judges, or was everybody very okay with that from the get-go?
People have generally been quite okay with it. One of the lesser hidden secrets of the judge program is that there is a very large percentage of the female judges who are dating judges. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're not sort of all over each other the whole time, people tend to be pretty relaxed about it.
Interesting. I know as a player, I've made a comment before that judges are kind of cute. I've named a couple on Twitter where it's like, how are you? Like, give me an infraction, please, you know? And it's very taboo, like, to be a player and mention that about a judge, or to be a judge and express interest in a player does seem to be a very big no-no. And I found it very interesting that there wasn't that same level of taboo behind it when a judge was interested in another judge.
I mean, most of the judges that I know who are not dating other judges are dating players.
Interesting.
And there's just generally, you know, if you're judging an event where they're playing, you kind of try to avoid being involved in their match. But if you do, you hope that if you do get involved in their match, and I have been involved in Daniel's matches before, and I don't think vice versa, you tend to just hope that people trust your professionalism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny, I've heard people talk about that and how, you know, quote unquote wrong it is, or how much of a bad idea it is. And I think as long as you're not going into it with that intention, like as long as you're not judging just to get dates and you're not going to event as a player just to pick up judges, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because I feel like it's almost like a lottery in a way, where it's like, you know, you're put in a room with several hundred people, you all have a common interest together. You're bound to find at least one person that you might find attractive, or that you might have, you know, had some conversation with and liked what you heard. So I don't think it's that unreasonable when those things happen. I always find it really odd when people are like, you know, how could you do that? And that shouldn't happen. And it's like, well, I think it would happen with any hobby. Like, let's say you were on a volleyball team, or let's say you were playing, you know, miniatures or whatever. You're just, the sheer number of people that you're exposed to, you're bound to find one that you might click with. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem really is obviously if you break up.
Yeah.
Then you have the situation where either you're forced to continue interacting with one another or continue being exposed to one another. And if one person doesn't feel that they can tolerate that, then they're effectively forced out of the hobby to an extent, which isn't cool. So that's the one danger with dating other magic people, I think.
Right. It's also really hard for people to not choose sides. Like, even the most well-meaning people who will go into it going, I swear I'm going to stay neutral, I'm not going to choose a side, somehow they end up always going to a side, and then that brings more people into it, and it just sort of turns into this black hole, and that's not good either.
Yeah, indeed. It's the same as dating within any kind of sort of relatively small group. There is always it always just makes it much more messy if it goes wrong.
See, I'm actually really surprised by how small this community is. Like, I remember a while back, I had a really bad run-in with another female player, and I didn't think I'd ever see her again. I didn't think she was anybody special. And after it happened, they were like, do you know you just swore at Lissa Jensen? And I'm like, who's Lissa? What? Huh? And then someone gave me her name, and I looked her up, and not only was she from my state, but we had several friends in common. She ended up top eighting a Grand Prix somewhere, and I was just like, God, kill me. And I didn't know. You know, I just assumed she was some nameless woman that I would never see again, and never mind that I told her hair was a weave and whatever. You know, and then I started to see her at events, and I'm just like, oh God, I can't. Oh, book. And yeah, I learned very quickly that this community is a lot smaller than we realize, and you do have to kind of watch your mouth, and because you will run into them again and again and again.
My equivalent to this story was in 2009, I played on the Pro Tour. I played a Pro Tour Kyoto.
Uh-huh.
It was the first split Pro Tour, and I'm terrible at 60-card formats, but pretty good at limited. So I figured that if I could 3-0 the draft, I only needed to scrape one win, I think. It was at the point that you had to be 4-4 or something in the constructed portion.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I go into the draft. I draft a really good deck, and I'm on target for making day two. And then in the second round of draft, I play far too conservatively, and I get blown out by Nicol Bolas, who is my arch nemesis and shall remain so forever. So I go into the third round of draft, knowing that I can't make day two, and my opponent asks me if I'll concede to him because he can make day two, and I decide that I don't want to because I think I can make an even record if I win, which doesn't make me day two, but does make me, you know, pride points. I have an even record.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I refused to concede. We played. I beat him. I knocked him out of day two. This player was Danis Rashid.
Mm.
Considering that I judge a lot of European GPs and have judged some Pro Tours, I run into him quite a lot. So yeah, about a year ago we talked about it. He was like, hey, do you remember? I was like, yeah. I was kind of hoping you didn't. But he's cool. It's cool.
I had a moment like that recently. I was at a WMCQ locally, and there was a PTQ the day after, and I was playing this guy. All I knew is his name was Ben, because he shook my hand. He's like, my name is Ben. Nice to meet you. We were playing a Jundmir, and I called him a timing Nazi. And the reason why I called him that is he's one of those people who breaks a turn down into so many seconds that it's almost like impossible to comprehend. So he had beaten me. I was getting ready to shuffle my deck. And with a Jundmir, it's typically best if you draw first. So I said, I will not play first. I will draw first. And he goes, why are you telling me this now? And I'm like, well, I'm telling you, and then what we're supposed to do? And he's like, technically, you could shuffle, tell me you're going to play first. And then when you present, you can change your mind and say you're going to draw first.
I don't think there's many judges who would be particularly happy with that, but you
right,
technically
can. Right, and I was like, you know, who does that? Like, who's that meticulous? I don't understand. So, you know, we sort of bickered about it a little bit, and I was just like, well, I'm not a timing Nazi like that, you know? And so we're going through the match. I look over at the slip, and it's Ben Rasmussen.
Okay.
And again, I'm like, are you, you're Ben Rasmussen? And he's like, yeah, is that a big deal? I'm like, oh, God, I just want to play from under the table for the rest of the round. Fuck. And and then afterwards, I made a comment about that. And my friends were just like, yeah, he's the furthest thing from a Nazi ever. And I'm like, oh, God, I've got to work on that. And yeah, I'm very bad at that. And of course, now Ben Rasmussen, of course, you know, my friends on Facebook, you mutual friends, Ben Rasmussen. And it's just small world. You can't escape those little mistakes.
Yeah, indeed. It's So I'm not entirely sure what happens. I'm pretty sure that my dad goes around wearing a badge saying my daughter is a level 3 judge, ask me about her or something. Because my dad repeatedly comes back with he's got two stories so far, one of which he was talking to one of his best friends who's currently doing a computing course at university. And anyway, his best friend suddenly said, oh, by the way, there are a lot of people in my class who all know Kim. And it turns out his class is like half UK Magic players or something. And I came up in conversation at some point. So that was one. But then the other one was my dad had an interview in America relatively recently. So it was over in the States, and he ended up talking to a group of people. And he came back from America, and he goes, yeah, I met... I think it's Jacob Van Loonen's wife. And it's just like, how do you even... How does this even come up in conversation? Like, how do you find out that one of the people you've talked to is the wife of an internationally known Magic player? Do you just kind of... hold up flags going, anybody in the room know magic?
Or maybe he uses like magic dialect in his conversations. So, you know, if he's in a job interview, they'll be like, you know, well, what skills do you have? And I'll be like, oh, you know, sometimes I like to, you know, I scavenge through my work very quickly. I spend a good old 3 black and a green to just plow through it. And sometimes I overload myself, you know, I do a 3 and 3 red. And, you know, maybe he's really cagey like that.
That would be an amazing coincidence, because while at one point he took enough interest to get me to teach him the basics of the game, I don't think he's well-versed in current keywords.
And we'll talk about keywords later, because even I'm a little confused about those.
Sure.
So let's get started. I kind of want to go back a little bit. You mentioned the basics. So what made you even decide that you wanted to be a judge in the first place, Kim?
So at first I was convinced I didn't want to be a judge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was a PTQ grinder back in sort of 2006, 2009-ish. I won a PTQ. I went to the Pro Tour, as I sort of mentioned. I did not make day two. And this Pro Tour was in Japan. I'd sort of gone out 10 days early to spend like 2 weeks traveling in Japan. That seemed great. I did it by myself. I had no plans beforehand. It was really fun. Downside is Japan's quite expensive and I hadn't realized.
Mm.
So I kind of got to the Pro Tour with no money. And scrubbed out of day one. And it was when Pro Tour still had side events. But it kind of meant that I was in this, I was in a town in, well, I was in Kyoto with no money at the Pro Tour with nothing to do. Mm-hmm. And so a judge kind of goes, I've been talking to you, some GPs and things. I think that you should shadow a judge on side events today. Mm. So I'm like, well, I'm not doing anything else, am I? So I shadowed a judge on side events, and 7 months later, I passed my level one.
Interesting. And what made you decide that you wanted to keep going and go for level two, level three, and do you have plans to go for level four?
Zendikar block was a really big reason why I kept going. At first I thought, okay, I can, you know, I'm not good at 60 card formats. I don't enjoy them. So, hey, I can judge limited and I can play limited and I can judge constructed. And then Zendikar blocked happened and I played one limited PTQ and decided that, six Zendikar sealed was the most miserable format on the face of the planet. an opinion which I think I still hold. And suddenly decided that actually I was going to judge the rest of that sealed season instead of playing it. And then from there, things kind of escalated. I don't do things by halves very much. I'm either very involved in something or not interested in it at all. And just over a year after I passed level one, I passed level two. And just under a year after that, I passed level three.
Mm-hmm. And do you have intentions of going for level four?
Level four is a complicated thing. You can't really go for it as such. It's... I mean, currently there are 9 level 4s in the world.
9?
9.
Wow. How many level 3s are there?
There are about 120 level 3s.
Wow, that's insane.
9 level 4s and 4 level 5s.
Jesus.
And level 4, level 5, you kind of get, as far as I can work out, you know, some black cowled figure, possibly Nathan Holt, hard to tell, comes and knocks on your door and invites you to level 4 at some point if they want you there. So I'm just going to continue doing what I do and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the difference between a level 3 compared to like a level 1 or a level 2 judge?
So in a sort of nutshell, a level 1 judge is what we call like a store judge now.
Mm-hmm.
They judge primarily at regular rel. They judge primarily in their one local store. So they'll be the person you see at F&M or the person doing pre-releases.
Sure.
A level 2 judge is then a sort of competitive floor judge. They tend to work slightly wide in a slightly wider area, maybe multiple stores. They floor judge at GPs. They're going to be the bulk of judges at GPs and at PTQs. You can have level 1s on PTQs, very rarely on GPs now. Mm-hmm. And then level 3s begin to become sort of international judges. Mm-hmm. So they can they head judge PTQs. They team lead at GPs. And then the other aspect of it as well, sort of aside from just what you can do event-wise, there's the involvement you have in the wider program. So level 2 judges can certify level 1 judges. Mm-hmm. Level 3 judges can certify level 2 judges or level 1 judge, well, and level 1 judges, and are also involved in certification of other level 3s.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, kind of your scope gets wider as you go up the judge program. The things you do are less involved just with making rulings on the floor, and you have a lot more, a lot more wider involvement. A lot of level 3s do... like extra projects and extra tasks and things like that outside of anything that players ever see.
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of provide education to the judge program and structure to the judge program.
Okay. Now, one of the common complaints that I hear from judges, not even a complaint necessarily, but they sort of muse about the fact that they really don't get to play very much anymore. it sounds like at your level that might be the case. Do you get to play anymore?
It sort of depends. I mean, arguably, when you're a judge, the absolute minimum requirement to maintain being a judge is to judge one event every 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you're in an area which is really starved for judges, you should more or less get to play as much as you would like, as much as you want to while you're still a judge, okay, while still being a judge. In my case, this doesn't always work out. For example, I really wanted to play the last WMCQ.
Mm-hmm.
There was a WMCQ, a PTQ on the same weekend. I was qualified somehow. Well, I did a couple of GPs, so I was qualified for the WMCQ, and it seemed like it would be fun to get a deck together and go down and play and get my ass kicked and carry on from that. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, our head judge had to pull out at the last minute, and as I was a level 3 with flights to the event, I ended up head judging it instead. Mm. So occasionally, I think occasionally you can have to jump into the breach. But as I said, I've played in a couple of GPs in the last year, which I didn't even apply to judge them. I just sort of decided I wanted to go and play them. So I played Attract, which is the team one, mm-hmm. and I played Manchester last year. I guess the one thing I don't get to do as much as I would like is PTQs. Mm-hmm. I tend to either not be doing them because I'm doing something else, like judging a GP, or end up traveling to them to head judge because there isn't another head judge available. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really hoping is that with the fourth Pro Tour and a second limited season in the year, as far as I can see, as a limited player, this kind of doubles the access to GPs I have, to PTQs I have, and I should be able to fit at least one in.
Now, what would happen if you were, now as a level 3 judge, are you able to compete competitively? Like, if you were to win a PTQ, you can go to the Pro Tour as a level 3 judge and play, correct?
Oh, yeah, indeed. Okay. I mean, Rob Castellan just did it as a level 2 judge, so... Okay. Yeah, there's no rules. There's pretty much you're only prevented from doing it when you have significant knowledge of sets and things.
Okay.
Which judges don't have.
Got it. Okay. So something you mentioned earlier, we talked a little bit about, you know, being a woman in the judges community. And would you, well, how would you say your experiences have been in that circle?
From the judges, they've been fine. Like I don't remember that ever being. Anything in specific from the judges, but I'll get into that in a minute. Mm-hmm. I'm a data nerd. I looked at this. from the players, when you're a level 1 judge in particular, when you're not very experienced, it's harder being female as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the reasons that we have relatively few female judges is that you just have to get over the level 1. You have to get over the hurdle of being a level 1 mm-hmm. in the face of competitive players who don't have a lot of respect for you. Mm. If you can get over that, so, you know, you start with your local players who gain respect for you and then it spreads. At the point that you get over that, then there's not really much difference. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was level 1, there was... all level 1s have problems at first where they're a little underconfident because they're mm-hmm. making rulings for the first time. And as a female judge, that kind of gets picked up on a lot more than it does for male judges. You get a lot of appeals, which is hard. You get players making comments about the stupid female judge that happened once. Mm. And that's quite difficult. But when you get over that, then sort of when you prove yourself as such, then there's suddenly no more questions. Even with players I've never met before, I've not had a problem for years. Mm-hmm. With regards to the judge program, as I said, I've never noticed any specific treatment. Though a few months ago, I looked at... So, a lot of judging works on reviewing each other. Mm-hmm. So you write reviews of judges that you've worked with where you sort of say, these are the things you do well, these are things you could do better, here are some suggestions for how to do them better.
Sure.
And it's kind of how we improve in the program. So I was looking at the amount of reviews that have been written of various people and things, and I noticed that female judges are disproportionately represented in the most reviewed judges by a significant margin.
Now, what that means is you're saying they're not getting as many reviews, or they're getting more?
They're getting more.
Oh. Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably because people are aware that female judges might suffer discrimination, and so they work really hard to have anti-discrimination. Okay. Like, a female judge is more noticeable because there are fewer of us, mm-hmm. and I think that makes people pay more attention. To try and, you know, help us because they know that we might face more hurdles. Mm-hmm. And so they're more likely to review us.
Okay.
But it amused me to notice that. And obviously it's a hypothesis that hasn't been tested, but it was a reasonable one from the pattern.
I can certainly understand the angle of wanting to make sure that your female judges are as competent as can be so that you're not giving people that ammo to use against them. I think that's a smart bet, I think.
Yeah.
So, would you say that the judges' circle provides a better environment for women than that of just being a player?
So this is another question which is difficult to answer because I have the feeling from talking to a number of female players in America that the atmosphere towards women in Magic is quite different between Europe and America, specifically the UK, which is obviously the one that I know the most. Mm-hmm. Where pretty much the only problems in the UK we get when even this isn't recently, has been, there's been some problems when a female player has won a PTQ and there's been stupid comments as a result.
Sure.
In America, I have the impression that there is a much more hostile atmosphere in general. Mm-hmm. I know specifically, last year I was talking to Jackie Lee quite a bit and was basically saying I didn't think that things were as bad as she was making out and other people were making out. And when she came over here to play in GP Manchester, afterwards she commented that the atmosphere was much more accepting at GP Manchester than it was in America, at American events.
Now, why do you think that is?
So we're running quite deep into my own personal theories and things here. I think that because we have many fewer ethnic minorities in the UK, a mm-hmm. much smaller proportion of ethnic minorities. So sure. I think that we've never had the race issue mm-hmm. in such a big way as it has been in America. Mm-hmm. And so as such, I think we've chosen our other issues that we absolutely have to have equality on. And I think that that means that the sex issue is something that we're more advanced on. Mm-hmm. And disability discrimination is a thing that we're really, really, really sensitive about as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's literally just, I don't think there's any huge driving this is better or this is worse. I think that there's, you know, at least one equality issue that has been less of an issue for us simply because it's not as in the spotlight, like it's mm-hmm. not as represented. And so we've got different attitudes to other equality issues as a result.
Well, now it makes me want to go and see, you know, what I would experience if I went to a UK event, because it sounds lovely.
I will not make any promises about the reactions of various UK players on anything I state about, because they'll obviously prove me wrong the instant that they get the chance.
I don't think I would ever get very far at a UK event, just simply by dint of the accents. I know there was a pre-release. There's a store in Chicago I like to go to with an English judge, and I've been known to be like, can you show me, can you tell me what that card does? And he'll be like, that's cypher. And I'm like, cypher? And he's like, it's supposed to be cypher, but he'll say cypher. And I'm like, really? That's, thank you, Mr. Judge. I appreciate that. And then something else will come around and be like, Judge, what does battalion do? And he'll be like, battalion. And I'm like, ooh.
Who is this English judge?
He's just a store judge. I think his name is Andy or so. But
okay.
He's English. So for a minute there, I pretend I'm slow and he'll read cards to me in English. And it makes me happy. So
I know a couple of UK judges who are over in America. One of whom, well, technically three. Two of whom are very high profile and one of which you would never guess.
Okay.
Obviously, there's James, is it James Elliott? It's the Scottish judge.
Never heard of him.
America for a while. He keeps getting called. I keep having people tell me that he's an English judge. Mike's not. He doesn't sound even remotely like one. The other one's Toby Elliott.
I don't know.
Has the level five, has got a Union Jack badge. He's British at some point in the distant past.
Interesting. I'm literally writing these down. Like, if they do podcasts, I'm in.
He does not sound very English, though. He's he's quite naturalized.
There goes that plan.
Sorry to disappoint.
That's okay. I have you here, and that is more than enough. So the other reason I wanted you here, Kim, other than getting to know you a little bit, is we've got some rules changes coming up starting in July, I believe. And I kind of wanted to talk about these because I know there's even some of these things that I'm confused about because they're things that I thought I understood and come to find out that I have no idea what they mean. And so we're going to break this down into a couple parts. So we're going to go over the rules. I'm going to break down what the rule is like right now. And then you're going to tell me how the rules are going to change and what that means for us. So are you okay with that?
Yep, sure. I was just pulling up yourdog.com so I can avoid saying anything particularly stupid.
Awesome. All right. So the first rule that looks like it's going to change is the legend rule. And as we know it right now, you can't have two legends of the same name on the board right now. So if I'm playing Olivia Valdarin and I'm playing a Jundmir match and my opponent plays Olivia Valdarin, they will kill each other right off the bat. That rule is going to change. How's it going to change?
Yeah, indeed. Basically, from July 13th onwards, when the state-based act, well, it's a state-based action that causes it to happen at the moment. From July 13th onwards, that state-based action will only consider your side of the board, not your opponent's side of the board. So you can, if you control Olivia and I cast Olivia, great, we both have Olivias. Whoever has five untapped mana first will have one Olivia, because when they steal the other one of them will die. Notably, if you end up with two of the same legend in play on your side of the board, you choose one of them to die rather than both of them sort of annihilating one another.
Interesting.
Which people are excited about with, for example, Gaea's Cradle, I think, was one of the big ones that people talk about. Mm-hmm. And Mox Opal, where several people claim to have broken Modern, so we'll have to see what happens there.
Interesting. Now, do you think this is a change that's going to be very big?
I think it's... Ironically, I think where it's going to be really big is Commander.
Mm.
Because it means that cloning your opponent's general isn't going to do much anymore. Apart from give you a copy of their general, which might be a good thing, depending on what it does, but it certainly doesn't kill their general.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it could impact other formats. Like, one can't discount the sort of Mox Opal effect when so many people claim to have made broken decks based around it. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I don't think the change is going to be as big as people seem to think they are. People seem to think it is. This is the one that everyone talks about quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Though I pray to God they never reprint Geist of St. Traft.
Fuck that card. I actually was playing Bant Hexproof the other day and beat it. And whenever I play a deck that runs Geist of St. Traft, I determine how well the match went by how many Geists I've killed. I may not even win the match, but if I've killed, like, I keep a tally and I'm like, I killed 4 Geists. And they're like, yeah, but you lost. I know, but I killed 4 Geists. Like, that's success to me.
Reasonable measure, I think.
Yeah. I'm excited about this rule. And I think the thing that made me the most interested in it was people have used the theory or the reasoning that clone was never meant to be a Doomblade, and the fact that that's the only reason that people were sideboarding in clones was to kill an Olivia or to kill a Geist, and that's just not what it was intended to do. And I like that it will make clone and effects like clone be just clones. I think that's
there
a
have
good
been some quite interesting Vorthos discussions about how it works.
Yeah, the Vorthos people have been up in arms about most of these things, especially the next one, actually. The Planeswalker uniqueness rule. So what this means right now is that when you look at the middle text of a Planeswalker, even if they have different names, it will still say Planeswalker Liliana. You could have Liliana of the Dark Realms, also known as Bad Lily, and you could have Liliana of the Veil, which is known as Good Lily, and even if they have different names, they will still cancel each other out, and similar to the Legends, they will destroy each other. That rule is about to change.
Yeah, this is going to change in effectively exactly the same way as the Legends, except it's a different state-based action, even though it does a very similar thing. You know, the legend rule looks at names in legendary cards. The Planeswalker uniqueness rule, as you said, looks at types in Planeswalker cards. But once again, it'll only evaluate your side of the board. So both if you cast a Jace of some kind and your opponent already controls a Jace of some kind, that's fine. You can both have your Jace. And once again, if you end up with a second one on your side of the board, you choose one of them to sacrifice. And I think this one is a much bigger change than the Legend rule, simply because of how Planeswalkers work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that a lot of people have commented on is that, at the moment, in formats with, for example, Jace the Mind Sculptor, playing first is an even bigger advantage than it was ever meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can get your Jace, if you can play your Jace the Mind Sculptor turn 4 and activate it, then if your opponent has one in hand, the best they can do is kill your Jace with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just got so much more value than they have. So that will no longer work. If your opponent plays a Jace, then they also have a Jace.
Mm.
It also turns off the ridiculous thing that people have been doing recently. Apparently, these are in formats I don't really play, so I'm taking other people's words for it. Where you start playing little Jace in your deck. Because if you're playing Little Jace, you can get Little Jace down before your opponent puts down Big Jace.
Now, what's Little Jace?
Little Jace is Jace Beleren, the one
okay.
that costs 1 blue-blue.
Okay.
So it comes down a turn earlier than Jace the Mind Sculptor.
Okay.
It's less good, but it does turn off your opponent's Jace the Mind Sculptors, which is a huge advantage.
Mm.
So once again, it's like the clones not being meant to be Doomblades. Now Little Jace is no longer an anti-Big Jace Doomblade. The point where you get some possibility of very interesting play in it is if you draw two of the same Planeswalker, it's not really a dead card anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, I could have my one Jace in play. I can Brainstorm with it. I can cast my second Jace. I choose which one to sacrifice, so I can sacrifice the one I've already used. And then I can effectively get a second activation by activating my other Jace.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, indeed.
Especially me being a Liliana player, like we talked about Bant Hexproof and how much it sucks. And I can just see myself going, you know, I have a Liliana out, sacrifice a creature, and then they'll pick like a mana elf or something silly just to sort of spite me. And I'll see myself casting another Liliana, sacrifice a creature, the right creature, thanks. Like
Liliana's one of the ones that really, really benefits because there's just so many, like I played Black White Zombies for a while. I played in a PTQ. I did actually play in a PTQ this season. It was a standard PTQ ages ago in Paris. And I was playing Black White Zombies, to an ignominious 1-2. And one of the things I established was that if you play Liliana of the Vale against a green-white opponent, then it's basically an edict for three. Like, you never activate the discard ability.
Yeah.
So now that card gets much better because you can, like, play your Liliana, edict, then you can play a second Liliana, sacrifice the first one, and edict again.
See, they think they're so bad with
one useless Liliana stuck in play, which is preventing you being able to play the second one.
See, they think they're so bad with their Loxodon Smiter. You know, you make them discard a card, and they're like, Loxodon Smiter. And it's like, that's nice, fucker. Sacrifice it. Like, just don't give me that.
Indeed.
Sideboards. This is something that I am guilty of. I have not purposely done wrong, but there have been times after the fact where I've never done terribly well in a tournament, but there have been times after the fact where it's like, shit, I didn't sideboard correctly. I had a card in there that I shouldn't have. Ah! The way it works right now is that you have 60 cards. You have your deck. You have a 15 or 0 card sideboard, typically 15. But when you substitute cards, you have to substitute them on a 1-for-1 basis. So if you're putting in a card from your sideboard, you have to take out a card from the main deck to replace that card. And I actually really like this change. What's the change going to be?
So the change is basically, as you said, right now for this only applies to constructed.
Mm-hmm.
But the change will be that you can have a main deck that is at least 60 cards,
mm-hmm.
and a sideboard which is up to 15 cards. So it doesn't have to be binary 0 or 15 anymore. It can be any number up to 15.
Okay.
Then the associated change is that as long as these two rules are respected, that the main deck is not less than 60 and the sideboard is not more than 15, you can sideboard as many cards in or out as you like. It no longer has to be 1-for-1, which is already how it works in Limited. There's no 1-for-1 sideboarding in Limited.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically brings the two formats into line.
Yeah, the reason I'm excited about this, and they mentioned this in the article, is that there have been times where people have accidentally, genuinely accidentally, not realized that they, after they've sideboarded, they now have a 61-card deck or a 62-card deck, or the opposite. You know, they sideboarded too much in 59, and then all of a sudden, you know, a judge comes around and does a deck check, and you receive a game loss for it, or you receive some sort of punishment for it, and, you know, it happens. I don't know. I mean, I've been lucky enough to associate with some high-level players, and it's happened to the best of us. And I like that it will sort of take that off the table, hopefully.
I mean, this is one that I've been able to avoid because I got into the habit early of counting my sideboard before I present, which does get you around it. But yeah, I mean, it stops stupid game losses in this respect, which is always nice. Like, judges don't actually like giving game losses for stupid things. Like, if you do something that blatantly deserves it, then fine. But yeah, really easy mistakes to make. Giving a game loss really sucks. So ways that reduce that are quite cool.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an interesting side to it where arguably it makes sideboarding even more skill intensive than it is currently. Because there is that time when there's like there's 5 cards you want to bring in, there's only 3 cards you want to take out, you don't know what the last 2 cards you should cut are. Now you can just kind of go, oh, I'll just bring in my 5 and play a 62 card deck.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, there are reasons that it's recommended that you play 60 card decks. You know, it's, you could play more, but it's recommended you try and keep to the minimum. So it allows people to kind of mess up in that respect if they're just not disciplined enough.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting.
So you think you would say it's not a good idea to go overboard and just put all, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 in there. You still think it's a good idea to do 1-for-1, essentially?
I think that's probably still going to be the correct thing to do in most cases, simply because, yeah, I mean, we try and keep decks to the minimum size that we're allowed to have because it increases the consistency. It increases your chance of drawing your good cards.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, most people's sideboards aren't going to contain much land.
Right.
So if you sideboard in 6 cards without taking anything out, then you're really diluting the amount of cut land in your deck to spells, and you're just increasing your chances of getting screwed that way as well.
That's a good way to look at it. I didn't think of that. I'm actually excited about the fact that sideboards can now be up to 15, because I've also seen that specifically with new players where, you know, my local FNM tends to be a bit more casual, and we do get some first-timers or some recent, you know, converts to the game, and sideboards have been sort of tough for them, where they're like, well, I've got 9 cards, and then people are like, nope, 0 to 15, and I'll admit there have even been times with decks that I've built where, you know, and sometimes you see this online, too, you'll see, like, a winning deck list in SCG, and the judges will go over the list list, and they'll be like, man, these cards are just such value. And then there's always that one or two like odd cards where they're like, why are these in the song? Oh, he needed 15, right? Like, just, it does lead to you sometimes making some odd choices just to say that you have 15 cards in your sideboard. And
I do hope that we don't lose the amazing Char Belcher sideboards by this, because Char Belcher has cool sideboards.
I don't know what that is, but I hear that word Char Belcher tossed around a lot, and it sounds kind of scary.
So Char Belcher is a legacy combo deck that basically it tries to use the card Char Belcher, which I can't remember exactly what it does, but
okay. I'll look it up involves, while you talk.
It involves looking through your deck until you hit a land and doing a large amount of damage to your opponents. So Char Belcher decks basically play a lot of storm cards and things, and pretty much no land or one land. With the idea that they basically go through that whole... They basically storm off with, like, Simeon Spirit Guide and Fast Mana Accelerants and deal a huge amount of damage to their opponent on the first couple of turns of the game and kill them. But what this means is that the deck doesn't really have much flexibility in terms of sideboarding. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't think it sideboards at all. So there's been a long and storied history of Char Belcher sideboards, which are basically, like, 15 themed cards that call any value. So I think one of the recent ones that was popular was the Planeswalker sideboard that has every creature with Planeswalk. Mm-hmm. The keyword ability, not the Planeswalkers, and then like Jace is the 15th card or something, because there's only 14 creatures of the Planeswalk.
Interesting. Okay, so it says reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal a land. Goblin Char Belcher deals damage equal to the number of non-land cards revealed this way to target creature or player. If the revealed land card was a mountain, Goblin Char Belcher deals double damage instead. Put the revealed cards on the bottom of your library in any order. So I'm assuming that deck would not run a lot of lands, would it?
I think it runs up to one. And that one is normally like a volcanic island or something, so it is a mountain.
Ugh, that's nasty.
And it mainly uses things like Simeon Spirit Guide and petals and things to have a lot of fast mana.
Ugh.
But yeah, they've had fun sideboards through history.
Now, this next change is something that I'm personally a little confused about, so hopefully you can clarify this. Indestructible is being promoted to a keyword. What is it right now if it's not a keyword?
Indestructible, as unblockable, is a thing.
Okay.
It is just a thing which is true about the permanent which has it.
Okay.
In effect, this means that it tends to act a lot like a keyword.
Okay.
There is a relatively narrow... suite of times where it doesn't, which ironically can come up in standard right now for hilarious effect. So, okay. I mean, at the PTQ I was at last weekend, there was a couple of examples that illustrated this really well. Mm-hmm. So one of them, I was called to a table where someone had cast Turn and Burn.
Fuck that card. Sorry.
Cast Turn and Burn on a Predator Ooze. Predator Ooze is indestructible.
Yeah.
Inherently, it is indestructible. Yeah. So in this case, you Turn and Burn the Predator Ooze, you effectively wipe all the text on the card, you do it 2 damage, and the Predator Ooze dies. Mm-hmm. This Predator Ooze had no counters on it. Mm-hmm. So, like, 2 minutes later, I was called to another table where someone has cast Turn on Burn on a Restoration Angel, mm-hmm. and in response, the Restoration Angel's controller has cast Boros Charm to give his to make his creatures indestructible.
Okay.
What this means in this case is the Restoration Angel doesn't die.
Okay.
So, most of the time, if you use a spell or something to give a creature, for example, a flying, mm-hmm. Turn and Burn will wipe off the flying because okay. you give the creature the ability Flying,
okay,
which means that when Turn and Burn makes it lose all abilities, it loses that.
Sure.
Because Indestructible is not an ability, you make it indestructible. When Turn and Burn resolves, it can't make it lose it because it doesn't have it; it just is. So
see,
it doesn't.
I'm confused buy. There.
Okay.
So you're saying that right now, as the way the rules go, if you give something indestructible that wasn't already, you're saying Turn and Burn can't take that away?
The point is you don't give something indestructible, you make something indestructible.
Okay.
You give something flying, but you make it indestructible.
Okay.
That's effectively the difference. Like, indestructible is a thing which is true about a card, whereas flying is an ability.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay, so this is why they're changing the rule.
Okay.
Because it's incredibly unintuitive,
yeah.
and nobody understands it.
Yeah.
So as of July 13th, if you turn and burn something and I borrow charm in response, it'll still die.
Okay.
Because indestructible will have a keyword and will act exactly like flying. You will give something indestructible.
Well, this sounds like something that people who use indestructible cards aren't going to like.
This is probably true, but I think that the number of times that happens is probably a little bit rare, because it'll only affect cards which have are made indestructible by another effect, not the ones which are inherently indestructible, because the ones that are inherently indestructible have a static ability that makes them indestructible, and they can lose that ability and thus not be indestructible.
Okay. So you mentioned the Predator Ooze example. So the example with Predator Ooze and Turn and Burn, as it stands right now, it would die to Turn and Burn, correct?
It will die to Turn and Burn, because it loses the ability that says Predator Ooze is destructible, like the sentence on the card,
okay,
is indestructible.
And then after the change, it'll still die.
It'll still die.
Ooh. No bueno. And then talking about keywords some more, you're saying that unblockable is not going to be a keyword?
Unblockable is just going to stop existing.
Okay.
They're just going to start writing can't be blocked on cards instead.
Now, what's the difference there?
Functionally, there's no difference.
Okay.
Except that at the moment, unblockable looks like a keyword. And when it says can't be blocked, it won't look like a keyword.
Okay, so if we were to go back to the turn and burn example, let's say I was going to try to hit you with, I guess, the reprinting Phantom Warrior, correct?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Let's say they are.
So let's say they're reprinting Phantom Warrior, and Phantom Warrior is, you know, unblockable.
Yep.
And then you try to target it with turn and burn. Right now, as the rules stand, would turn and burn remove unblockable?
Right now it would. So Phantom Warrior is like the Predator's example.
Mm-hmm.
It has the words on the card saying Phantom Warrior is unblockable.
Okay.
Are a static ability, and Turn and Burn will remove that.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think if there are any cards in the format. Wait, is Artful Dodge in the format?
Yes, it is.
Artful Dodge. Right. So if you Artful Dodge your thing, which is not... If you Artful Dodge your Grizzly Bear,
mm-hmm.
and the Grizzly Bear is then Turn and Burned, the Grizzly Bear is still unblockable because it doesn't have the ability is unblockable. It just is.
Okay.
And that'll stay the same. Except that instead of saying it's unblockable, we'll just say it can't be blocked, because then it doesn't look like a keyword, and it shouldn't, so it doesn't look like it should act like one.
Okay. So this change after the fact, so once the rules change, and you've got a Phantom Warrior coming at your face, and you try to turn and burn it, will the turn and burn still make it unblockable?
Basically, nothing is going to change in how unblockable works. It's just that it's going to be reworded, so it looks like it works like it does.
Okay, so a turn and burn would essentially not stop a Phantom Warrior from coming at your face. Unlocked.
It will still stop the Phantom Warrior, but it won't stop the Grizzly Bear who's been Artful Dodged.
That's so confusing. Ah, okay. I think I understand now. So the moral of the story in these two cases, if I'm understanding it correctly, is giving something to something that doesn't already have it, whether it's indestructible or unblockable, will not lead to it being taken away with things like turn and burn? I'm wrong,
more
aren't
specifically,
I?
More specifically, if the card giving a thing is worded target creature is X this turn.
Okay.
Then it's not going to get taken away because it just is that thing.
Okay.
If it says target creature gains X this turn, then it actually has gained the ability and thus it can lose it.
Got it. Okay, see, I didn't think of it like that. That cleared up a whole lot for me, so thank you.
No worries.
Okay. Now I understand, because I was getting ready for the show, and I remember rereading this very carefully. I literally had my finger on the screen. I'm like, creatures or permanents you control, trying to let it sink in, and it just wasn't connecting. So, okay.
As long as you weren't highlighting it, you're probably...
I'm a blonde. I'm a redhead, not a blonde. There's not like a white out on my screen or anything. Just.
I thought one of the other words for redhead was strawberry blonde.
I'm actually more of a copper penny redhead, so...
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so if you have any pennies, that's me, just... Right there.
I have plenty. You sort of accumulate.
Okay, so this other one seems to be kind of redundant. Maybe it's just me. There's a thing about playing additional lands. And as it stands right now, whenever you play a land, if more than one rule or effect would allow you to play that land, you have to specify which rule or effect you're using. I kind of always do that. Maybe that's just me. I guess the rules are going to change. How are they going to change?
Okay, so this one is incredibly academic because, firstly, most people aren't as brilliant as you and do play their lands badly.
Okay.
And secondly, these situations are not particularly common.
Okay.
So to take the Oracle of Moldiah example, mm-hmm. I control an Oracle of Moldiah that says I can cast an extra land. I can play an extra land in my turn.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I have my lands. I play a land. I say this is the Oracle of Moldiah land. Afterwards, you kill my Oracle of Moldiah. I can still play my second land. I can still kind of go, well, this is my land for my turn then. Like, the other land drop I used was my Oracle of Moldiah land drop.
Mm-hmm.
Which is ridiculous and academic and confusing and not really how we try to word things anymore in the way that we try to be more friendly and accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, for example, I play a land and go, land for the turn, and you kill my Oracle of Moldiah, I don't get to cast a I don't get to play a second land.
Right.
So it's literally just like I have to say which land it is, and if I do it in the right order, I can, and my guy dies, I can play two, and if I do it in the wrong order and my guy dies, I can play one.
Hmm.
Except when nobody even bothers saying what that land is for, this makes loads of problems. Like, say I play a land, you kill my Oracle of Moldiah, I've not said anything. Can I play another land or not?
No, you can't.
Like, but why not?
Because
never said which one that land was.
But it's because you didn't say it that then the assumption is that was your land for turn.
Either way.
Okay.
It's a mess.
Okay.
This rule is being changed to stop being a mess.
Okay.
Which is basically, like, you will have your number of land drops.
Mm-hmm.
By default, your number of land drops is one.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an Oracle of Moldiah in play, your number of land drops is two.
Mm-hmm.
So you can play one land. If your Oracle of Moldiah is then killed, your number of land drops is one again.
Okay.
So you can't play a second land. Like, the number of land, it basically all it looks at is how many land drops do you have in a turn? How many land drops have you made this turn? And if the number of land drops you've made is less than the number of land drops you have, which can constantly be adjusted by things happening in the game, then you can play another land.
Okay.
So if they're equal, you can't play any more lands.
Okay, so going back to your Moldiah example. So let's go for the new rule changes. So once the rule changes come into effect, let's say you have your Oracle, and
yep.
you say that the land you're playing is per your Oracle. That's your Oracle land drop. So you're saying, I'm dropping my Oracle land. Someone kills your Oracle. So now with the rules change, because you designated that land your Oracle land, does that mean you don't get to play your normal land, or?
Basically, it's irrelevant that you've designated your land.
Really? So you're done. You don't get to play another land regardless.
Yep, you're done. You had two land drops at the point that you made that one. You now have one land drop, and you've made one land.
Interesting.
So you're done.
Hmm.
Fortunately, you can't kill someone's Oracle of Moldiah in response to a land drop, so they could just drop two lands straight away before you have the chance to kill it. But yeah, it basically takes away the confusing bit in the middle, which is like, wait, what land was that? Did I name the land? Did I do it correctly? And it just makes it, how many lands do I have? How many lands have I played? Brilliant.
See, I would be guilty of what you said, where you're just putting two down at a time. Like, if I knew that that was even a remote possibility, I would just be like, two lands! I have an Oracle!
<That's>, I think that's probably normally better, too.
I would just hold them really tightly and just sort of guard them, like, no!
Yeah,
I'm taking these from me. Because I play a lot of removal spells, so.
Like, basically, it's quite an academic change. Mm-hmm. It's probably not going to affect most people ever. But it just means that things work in a way which, well, it took me about 30 seconds to explain it as opposed to about 5 minutes.
Right. Now, these are changes that, to me, you have mentioned that a lot of these are really academic and intricate, and it sounds like these are changes that probably wouldn't have come up if it weren't for some sort of feedback from the judges' circle. Would you agree with that? Like, do you guys get any input? Like, do you have a way to say to Wizards, you know, hey, these mechanics are a little, you know, they're coming up a lot. People really don't get them. Do you get to suggest anything like this?
We can't, like, most of us don't have the ability to suggest it directly to Wizards. The judges obviously discuss this kind of thing, and level 4 and level 5 judges in particular do have an impact on rules and policy. Well, definitely on policy. Possibly on rules, I'm not certain.
Okay.
There is a you know, a pit of death. Sorry, there is a place called the Wizards Community Rules Theory and Templating Forum,
Oof.
which one can find by Googling Magic Rules Templating Forum,
Okay.
where people who desperately care about these things can discuss small corner case awkward details in the rules, how things work and how they think things should work. This is on an official Wizards Community forum. I don't dare go anywhere near it. Most sensible people don't dare go anywhere near it. But as a quick look now, there are 60 pages and the most recent post has 499 views, so apparently some people like it. And technically it is an official Wizards forum. I don't know how much they look at it, but it means that they can look at it should they wish to. So this is a way that things can be fed back, or discussed at least.
So these changes that have come up recently, as a judge, do you approve of these changes, and do you think they're heading in the right direction with these?
Like generally, yes. Especially things like the unblockable, the indestructible, and the land drop changes, because those basically make the rules work like people think they should work, which makes life much easier as a judge when you're not having to say to a player, "No, honestly, get back to me later. You know, please carry on playing your match right now. I do not have the time to discuss the full theory." I know a lot of judges have panicked a little bit, especially less experienced judges, about the sideboarding changes. Because, you know, how do you know that somebody's deck list is illegal? Well, basically, the exact same way that we did anyway. Like, as I said, a main deck can be up to 60 cards. So a player can list. No, sorry, a main deck has to be at least 60 cards, so it can be over. So a player can list 61 or 62 cards. And we don't know if that deck list is legal or not. I mean, technically, having that number of cards is legal. And we don't know if that player has just made a mistake and meant to play 60. Normally, we don't care. This basically just means sideboards are going to work the same way. If somebody has written a 13 card sideboard, then we don't know if they meant to play 15 cards or not, but their sideboard is legal. There's no particular reason to go and look at them, especially, except the fact it'll be very easy to check. So you might, if you list a 13 card sideboard, get a judge who wanders over at one point and asks to count your sideboard quickly and has a word with you if it's more than 13 cards.
Interesting. Sounds.
With the Legend rules and the Planeswalker rules, I mean, judging wise, I don't think it really affects anything. The one place where it does make a difference, which I'm quite happy with, is at the Dragon's Maze pre-releases. At one point, I looked over at the table next to me. At regular events like pre-releases, you're allowed to act as a judge and a player at the same time. So pre-releases, FNMs, regular rel events. So I'm there playing my match. I look over at the table next to me where there's a Mirko Vosk blocking a Mirko Vosk. And it's a little bit sad to have to say to those players, guys, something here's not right. And you know. And then like another situation I had at the PTQ last weekend was somebody activated their Garruk Relentless's second ability to fight a beast that was made by the other person's Garruk Primal Hunter.
There must be a little part of you where it's like, even though you know what you need to do, there has to be a little part of you that's like, you know, I'm curious as to how this goes down. Like, maybe I shouldn't say anything.
But yeah, it just simplifies things. Like at regular rel, it's better for the players. They can play their cool legends without worrying about it. You don't have to be the horrible, fun-crushing person who goes, "Hey, wait, guys, no, actually, neither of you can have that cool legend. They're both going to the graveyards now because you're both stupid." Obviously, I don't mean that they're stupid. I mean they just played it without paying attention. And it makes things like that. It makes things like the two Garruk situations much easier to solve because that one was a doozy.
Sounds like it would be. So, Kim Warren, if anyone has enjoyed what you said on my show or just enjoyed you in general, where can people find you? How can they get in touch with you?
I'm largely all over the internet. The easiest places to find me are probably Facebook, because I currently have somewhere near 1 million Magic players as friends, so you can probably Facebook Kim Warren and find that there are some mutual friends with me and find me that way.
You're not friends with me, Kim Warren.
I'm very sorry.
I get it. You're on a meme now. You don't need to hang out with little folks like me. I get it. I totally get it.
Hey, you know what? I think you're wrong. I think I'm friends with you. I think you just haven't accepted my friend request.
And to think I was going to buy a t-shirt with your meme on it. I mean...
I do like being able to use the internet while I'm doing this. The other way is I'm on Twitter. Mm-hmm. My username is Fellwolf, spelled pretty much exactly as it sounds. Mm-hmm. I'm quite active there. Some might say that I have too much free time.
I have 67,000 tweets. You don't get to say that.
It's true. I am nearly on 10. I passed 10,000 yesterday. I noticed I was on 9,999. I was like, I should say something really poignant for the 10,000th one, and then I didn't. And then I was just like, screw this. And then sent 80 tweets since then. This is what happens when there's two GPs on in the weekend. Very happy to see that. Very happy to see some of the guys who've made the Gothenburg top 8, though. There's a couple of really cool guys who I'd seen at a lot of GPs and who are genuinely nice people, mm-hmm, in there, which is always good to see.
Yeah. Now, I am a little disappointed, though, about something, Kim Warren.
Uh-huh.
When we started this conversation, you forewarned me that you were going to be using lots of British words, and I have not heard a single British word this whole show.
Okay, so here's the trick. I don't know which ones are British. I just know that I say them, and then an American friend goes, what? What the hell are you on about? It's like, oh, bollocks.
There we go. There we go. I did it all for the bollocks.
So that's happened a few times.
So we could basically say that you Skyped me just now?
No, we probably couldn't. No, I don't think it works like that.
Oh, God. You told me about this awesome word called skiving. And yep. Skiving? Yeah.
Skiving. Skiving. Okay. Skiving is when you skip school or skip work without telling anyone when you should be somewhere else and you're not.
Oh, see, I was hoping.
So something... for example, it could be said that, seeing as I have a reputation for doing all the European GPs, I'm currently skiving by not being at GP Gothenburg.
Oh.
But on the other hand, I'm doing this because I'm currently learning optimization methods for an exam in 3 days. So I think that's okay.
Gotcha. So I get to tell all my friends Kim Warren skived with me today. That's, yeah.
Just they'll probably think you said Skyped, and then, you know, it'll just lose all resonance.
Well, it will mean something to me. And then when I type it out, they'll be like, what could that possibly mean? I'll just be like, I'll never tell.
Ironically, I keep finding other Britishisms from the fact that so I'm currently studying in France. Mm-hmm. I just wrote up my report for my internship.
Okay.
It got in English, and ironically, I found several Britishisms from that, because obviously everyone here knows American English because all of the TV shows are American.
Right.
Which means that I have French people going, "What does that word mean?" I was like, oh. And every time I Google it, like, I've not made this saying up. It's like, British English. It's like, oh, okay.
And it never sounds the same when it comes out of an American's mouth. Like, for example, I made a couple friends through WoW who are English, and one of them tried saying, you mad as a box of frogs?
Yep.
And I remember when I said it, it came out wrong. I was like, you're mad as a cage of frogs. And they were like, it's box, actually. Box.
Really, that's an obvious one. I mean, if you've tried to put a frog in the cage, they're slippy, they go through the bars. Yeah. It's very difficult.
But then, see, I tried teaching them. So, like, for example, I used the phrase hot mess. So, are you familiar with
that? I have no idea what that means.
Okay, so let's say you get out of bed and you haven't brushed your hair yet and you're wearing your most hideous pair of sweats and you've got, like, a dirty Guild t-shirt on, you haven't brushed your teeth yet, and you go to answer the door. You would say to your friends, man, you know, I answered the door today and I was a total hot mess. That's what you would be. So my English friend tried using it. She's like, so I went to work today and I was a hot mess. And it's like... there you go. Like, good, you got it. You know, so we're teaching each other fun little phrases like that. So it's what it's all about.
Oh, it's cultural exchange. It's the important thing.
So the next time you're at an event, Kim Warren, and you see someone being a total disaster, I want you to think to yourself, that person is a hot mess.
I think the next time I'm actually at an event is going to be in the States, where I'm doing a number of them. So I'll be able to actually try it.
Okay. And trust me.
See, you're just making this up entirely.
I can just see you pulling aside like some poor American judge, like, so that guy over there, is he a hot mess? And they'll be like, yes.
or you're just trolling me massively, and they'll be like, what?
No, you will. I assure you.
Are you being British again, Kim? No, I don't think so. I can assure you I'm not.
I assure you will find plenty of hot messes at American events. I'm sure of it. So this has been a lot of fun, Kim. Thank you so much for coming on my show, and I really, really do appreciate this chance to get to know you and for walking me through some of the rules that I didn't understand, and now that I do.
Alrighty, anytime.
So for anyone listening to the show, if you've enjoyed the Deck Tees, you can, of course, find me first on legitmtg.com. Then you can find me on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Feel free to subscribe and leave me a positive review. Other than that, if you have any personal feedback, you can find me on Twitter at OriginalEstrus. That is OriginalEstrus. Or you can email me directly at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye. Control.